The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brent Nuchtigal. I'm here in Edstone, England, in the sound booth here with Sam Livingston. We're coming to you live today, and I'm replacing Mr. Stephen Flurry. Thank you very much to him for letting me have the opportunity. I'm normally in Israel, Jerusalem, Israel. I have the Watch Jerusalem podcast that airs 10 a.m. Sundays back there in Edmond, Oklahoma. But today I get to fill in on the big program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And we're going to be talking about Israel and then also the Middle East, but some really critical things that you're not going to hear elsewhere, I can assure you of that. On the second half of today's show, we're going to be talking about President Trump's Iran policy in conjunction with what's going on in North Africa right now. North Africa is facing the greatest period of destabilization since the Arab Spring back in 2011 and 2012. Those are critical years, 2011 and 2012, in terms of biblical prophecy being fulfilled and how close we came to the united, biblically prophesied King of the South from existing. And we're going to talk about that in the second half. I'm going to zoom out, make it simple, I hope, to understand and see really how Mr. Trump's action in the United States and how Mr. Stephen Flurry has obviously talked a lot about how he is saving America temporarily from the radical left. We're going to see also how, in terms of foreign policy, Mr. Trump has actually stopped the trigger for World War III momentarily as well. But first, I want to highlight a little bit about Mr. Netanyahu's victory. He's obviously going to be the prime minister once again. He's going to start his fifth term as prime minister. And just 3 months into that term, he will become the longest running prime minister in the state of Israel's history, beating out David Ben-Gurion. And so really what's interesting about this victory is the polls, again, of course, were a little bit off. The polls before this election seemed to think that the Blue and White Party that is led by former General Benny Gantz, that was going to finally dethrone, that party was going to finally dethrone Mr. Netanyahu from his office as prime minister. But both of those parties won, the Likud party that Mr. Netanyahu represents and Benny Gantz's Blue and White party, they won 35 seats each of the 120 seats available in the Knesset. And this is a really interesting, or the way that their parliament is worked up, worked out, how power is distributed. It means that the party with the most votes or is most likely to be able to cobble together a coalition of the other parties, I think there was about 20 or something on the ballot, whoever can cobble together this coalition to break 60 seats or break the half the Knesset gets to then be the prime minister. And so just yesterday, I think it was, President Reuven Rivlin, he said to Mr. Netanyahu that you can have the opportunity to form a coalition. And so now he's got a week or so to find coalition partners, show that he can have over 60 seats inside the Knesset, and then from there he'll become the prime minister. So though while he looks like he has won the election, he's not officially going to be the prime minister until he works out, or his renewed office of prime minister won't be worked out until he gets that ruling coalition. But it looks like it's going to happen. Really, this was a referendum on Mr. Netanyahu's rule inside Israel. It's not often that you have in a democracy a leader be continuously elected, especially when in terms of Israel has so many issues inside society, so many domestic issues, there's so much political infighting that it looks like the government is on the verge of collapse all the time. Now, from the outside, it just looks like, of course, yeah, he'll be the prime minister. He's been around so long. Israelis love him, it seems. He's so right-wing, and all the Israelis are right-wing, that he's going to become back. He's going to be in power again. It's just not that way inside Israel. He is considered a centrist by most, not left-wing, not necessarily right-wing. He has plenty of right-wing parties inside his coalition because they wouldn't want to go with the left-wing parties. But really, they're voting for him because Israel right now is experiencing an amazing time of economic growth. It feels underneath his leadership quite safe. They see that Mr. Netanyahu understands the threats that the nation of Israel is under. And so they have elected him again. If you break down the people that actually elected him, though, it's quite interesting. Obviously, his party won out mostly in Jerusalem because they didn't want the blue and white party to rule because they were going to be allied with the leftist parties. And Jerusalem, it tends to be more conservative. And so Likud scored 25% of the vote in Jerusalem. So Mr. Netanyahu's party only scores a quarter of the vote, but the blue and white party only scored 10% of the vote. You also have a lot of the religious Jews or ultra-Orthodox Jews that have their own parties. They receive 23%. But what's interesting, if you look towards Tel Aviv, this is a liberal city. It's the largest city in Israel, obviously, beating out Jerusalem by a few hundred thousand people. In Tel Aviv, Benny Gantz's blue and white party took 54% of the vote, and Likud, Mr. Netanyahu's party, only took 9%. And so you have this division that exists in Israel that we see actually in the United Kingdom. We see it also in the United States, where you have the conservative working class populations that are voting with their feet, or did so, voted for Mr. Trump, much to the chagrin of the ruling class, of the intellectuals, of the academics, that can't believe that the people would vote that man into office. Well, you still have this. You have the same division even here in the UK with the pro-Brexiters compared to the ruling class again. The modern day aristocrats that the academics that want to pull out or that want to stay in Europe, you have that division here in the UK, and you also have it in Israel. You have it in Israel where the everyday conservative votes in again Mr. Netanyahu, with all his flaws, pending indictments for breach of trust and fraud and these other things that might come down the pipe. Nevertheless, they elected him, and you have the ruling academics and intellectuals in Tel Aviv that can't believe it, that can't believe it that it's happened again. And yet, as I said, Israel is having a resurgence right now. We talk a lot about the United States resurgence, and the little nation of Israel is doing exactly the same thing, and that's probably partially to do with the relationship that Mr. Trump has with the state of Israel, and specifically with Mr. Netanyahu. So this is something what we're going to watch. There is a growing divide inside Israel between the, as I said, the intellectual class and from Tel Aviv, the more liberal parts of society, and also the more conservative parts of society in Jerusalem and elsewhere. And we'll see where this goes. I do also want to bring you a little some greetings from Dr. Eilat Mazar. She's somebody we work with quite closely in Jerusalem. We've worked with her closely for the past decade or just over on the Palace of David excavations, the Ophel excavations, and others. Of course, we have a relationship with her going back 50 years to her grandfather, Dr. Benjamin Mazar. And I got to speak with her a couple of times over the past couple of weeks. And she did want me to pass along her, what does she say, her greetings or her thank yous to all of the people that we're associated with, all the people of the Philadelphia Church of God that support her work. And you listening to this show, I'm of course, as well, I think you're included in that. So Dr. Mazar, thanks you very much for your support. We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we will talk about what's going on in North Africa and how it really does affect your life. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the show. We are going to talk now about what's happening in North Africa. In terms of Mr. Trump's policy with Iran and comparing that to the policy of Mr. Obama, and all these things are going to come together in a way that I think is going to be very compelling to you. I want to start off with just going through two prophecies to set this up. And you're familiar with these prophecies. These are ones that we cover quite often when we talk about the Middle East and the United States right now. They're prophecies for our day. The first one of these is over in Daniel chapter 11. Now, understand that this is a supremely important chapter of prophecy. This is a prophecy where Daniel, an aged man at this time, probably 80 years old, he has been just been tormented for about 21 days because he knows that this message that he's going to receive is important. Gabriel, one of the archangels, is trying to deliver this message to him. He can't deliver it by himself. Michael, the other archangel, comes along to help him. Gabriel deliver this message to Daniel to fight against Satan, to be able to document this prophecy that we're going to go through. And that's in Daniel chapter 10. And here we are in Daniel chapter 11 with a dramatic prophecy that shows us the trigger for World War III. That's how critically important this is. And we're going to read through this because it has everything to do with North Africa as well. North Africa can be a very confusing place. Aren't they all fighting, always fighting in North Africa? What's the big deal? Aren't they, you know, a bunch of Islamists or not Islamists or strong? Don't they have strongman leaders? How are they going to affect me in the United States, down in Australia, elsewhere in the world? How will they affect you? How will actions in those countries affect you? Well, those nations, they're part of Iran's growing empire that needs to be completed, put together before the trigger for World War III goes off. And so instability in North Africa and Iran's movements into North Africa is an area that we can watch, we should watch very closely, because that's how we know where we are in prophecy. And this is what God was giving through Daniel. Here it is in verse 40. And at the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him. So this king of the south we've been talking about for three decades now as a radical Islamist camp led by Iran. Now, no one else has been talking about this for three decades. And so when we see this taking place, when we see radical Islam's rise and Iran at the very center of it, we know that this prophecy is beginning to come true, and it's going to have a pushy foreign policy. You see here, it pushes at him, this king of the north, as we've covered so often, and as we have literature that can help you with understanding this, king of the north is a German-led Europe, a Christian German-led Europe that this radical Islamist camp is going to push at. And this king of the north, then, he's going to retaliate. He shall come against him, that is the king of the south, like a whirlwind with chariots, with horsemen, many ships. And he's going to enter into the countries. That is, this European army is going to enter into the Middle East after being provoked by the king of the south. He's going to overflow and pass over, and he shall enter also into the glorious land. Glorious land, that's right. He's coming to the little nation of Israel as well. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. These are many of those nations that make up the modern day nation of Jordan. So Jordan's obviously going to be allied with this German-led Europe, not part of the radical Islamist camp, because he is saved. But other nations are taken out by this king of the north when he comes down, after he's been pushed, again, by radical Islam, by a conglomerate of nations that, or where political Islam rules, and we'll talk about what that means. These are some of those nations that are going to be allied with Iran. And he shall stretch forth his hand, that is the king of the north's hand, also against these countries. The land of Egypt is not going to escape, it says in verse 42. So Egypt's going to be allied with this king of the south, or Iran, and as it leads radical Islam. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps also. So we've got, if you get out a map, and Mr. Gerald Flory has talked about this and gone through this, take a look at a world map, and you can see where this European army is pushing down into the Middle East. And what's it talk about? It talks about Egypt being targeted. It talks about Libya being targeted. It talks about Ethiopia being targeted. And so if you get a map, this is talking about everywhere from Libya on the southern Mediterranean, across into Egypt, which is just to the east of it, and down through Sudan into Ethiopia, Eritrea, that region. Biblical Ethiopia, or the word here in Hebrew for Ethiopia, does imply more than just the nation of Ethiopia today. It's basically this whole territory along the western part of the Red Sea. This is a key bit of territory that is going to belong to an Iranian-led king of the south, and that's why the king of the north is there. Right now, that is not the case. Iran does not hold sway over Egypt, does not hold power in Libya, does not hold power in Sudan. And yet, right now, we have this moment of destabilization and war inside Libya. And you have the government of the strongman that's been in power for 30 years in Sudan just been overthrown. And so, we haven't seen this level of uprising, people uprising, or population uprising, since 2012, and that's a critical year as we'll get to. So, just to break this prophecy down again, we have Iran, and Iran at this point is in cahoots with Iraq, already maintains control over Iraq. And then we have the other side, if we can call it the western arm of the king of the south, comes out from Mesopotamia, jumps over Israel, jumps over Lebanon, and jumps over Saudi Arabia, and now it controls this western arm of Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. So Iranian control of this territory is a critical precursor for the push. It needs to happen before the push can happen. Iran needs to control Ethiopia up through Libya for this to happen. And once they do that, then they will push to ignite the world that, again, if you look on the rest of these verses in Daniel chapter 11, will lead to the trigger being pulled for World War III. Now, this was really close to happening back in 2012. It was really close to happening in the Arab Spring, or I like to call it the Islamic Spring, because that's what it really was. It was dictatorships of anti-Islamist rulers falling and the rise of Islamist powers into politics. In Egypt, and they attempted to do that in Libya unsuccessfully, and in Sudan, you already had an Islamist in power. But here we have a situation in the Middle East where it looks like there might be a return to this moment in history. Now, back in 2012, in 2011, we had a different president of the United States. We had a president of the United States that actually encouraged this to happen. This was a stated policy of his to turn over strongman rule, even if they are allied to the United States, like Mubarak was, and work with grassroots moderate Islamic powers as they see it, as he saw it, and as those in his administration saw it, even if they be likes of the Muslim Brotherhood and such. So I just want to go now to another prophecy that is not about the Middle East necessarily, but it has everything to do with the foreign policy of the United States. And so that's why it's important. 2 Kings chapter 15 in verse 23 to 27 talks about the reign of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II was a figure that ruled over the northern tribes of Israel around 750 BCE. And he led, I think it was about 50 years or 40 years, something like that. And it was a period of national revival, not religious revival. There was no return to God during this time. And yet the nation was blessed. The nation was blessed. They expanded in territory all the way down, or in alliance with the southern territories of Judah, Kingdom of Judah. They ruled all the way down to Eilat, the Gulf of Aqaba. They actually ruled up past Damascus into modern-day Syria, basically expanding the domain of Jeroboam in 750s around to almost the size of King Solomon's kingdom. That's how big it was. Now, the reason for this had nothing to do with righteousness, had nothing to do with God blessing the people because they were good or fulfilling his law. This is what it says here in 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 25. He restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the Sea of the Plain. This is Jeroboam II, according to the word of the eternal God of Israel, which he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, which was of Gath-Hepher, a territory in the land of Zebulun in the north. And this is why God did it, verse 26, for the Eternal saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, and there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor helper for Israel. And the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. And so God actually saved the northern tribes for a period, because of his mercy, because of his love, because he cared so much for his people Israel that he would even use an unrighteous king to give them a moment to repent before the Assyrian kings came down and wiped them out and took them into captivity. That's what it was anciently. And we know that there is a prophetic type of this Jeroboam II alive today, in power today, because we can base other prophecies, such as Amos chapter 7, which is a prophecy for our time. We have a Jeroboam mentioned there in Amos chapter 7, ruling over Israel. And if you want to figure out who Israel is, you really need to request our booklet, the United States and Britain in Prophecy. It goes through biblical proofs of who modern-day Israel is today, and it is made up predominantly by the English-speaking peoples of the United States and Britain, British Commonwealth. And so there is a Jeroboam type that is momentarily saving the name of Israel. And we've spoken a lot about that. And if you want to read more about that, you can read Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. And this is just one quote from that article. It says here in this article, I think it was from a year and a half ago or something like that. Had Hillary Clinton been elected, the destructive trends that unfolded during the Obama presidency would have continued unchecked, and they surely would have intensified. Many people, including me, believe it would have meant an end to our constitutional republic. So this is Mr. Gerald Flurry writing here. He's saying that if this Jeroboam II didn't come on the scene, this modern-day type of that, that the trajectory was bad for the nation of Israel. It would have been the end to our constitutional republic. Now, I want to talk about this in terms of foreign policy. The foreign policy of the United States under Mr. Donald Trump has, because he was saving Israel, has also led in a way to the saving of the rest of the world from the march of radical Islam. It was in full swing under the Obama presidency administration. And it would have continued into the third and fourth terms of his office, or Hillary Clinton's office, if she became prime minister, because she was with it as well. She was the Secretary of State for a long time. She was behind this outreach to moderate Muslim nations as well. She was one of those that had the first engagement, the early engagement, even before she was Secretary of State, with people from Iran in Oman, meeting with them in private discussions, secret discussions before the nuclear deal came out. This was a strategy of theirs. And so here we have, if we think in terms of foreign policy, of this man that God is using to save the United States and Israel temporarily, if we think about him and his foreign policy objectives, what's number one? Number one for him is to stop Iran. number one foreign policy objective for the Obama administration was to unrestrain Iran or let loose Iran. Let loose Iran and other Muslim nations to embrace political Islam. And we'll go through proof of that. But we don't, I mean, we don't have to have too much proof. You know the nuclear deal and everything that went into that. This nuclear deal, though, it was signed. Well, it was never signed, actually. It was never a treaty or anything like that. It was just agreed to by the parties. That was implemented in January 16, 2016. But they were working towards that for the 4 years previous. They wanted to work with this moderate Islamist, as they saw it, President Rouhani, when he came into office. That's the narrative that Ben Rhodes, his national security advisor for a time, and his speechwriter, Mr. Obama's speechwriter, drew up. And that wasn't just, it wasn't just, this outreach wasn't just to Iran. It was also to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and allowing the fall of Mubarak there to let democracy have its course inside Egypt. And we tend to glorify democracy these days. And it does have its value for sure. But you go to the Middle East and you can't find a successful democracy of an Arab or Muslim state that hasn't eventually gone over to Islamism. Most of them are, you know, Islamic nations. But there's a difference between somebody that, a nation that rules with Sharia, the Islamic law, as its guiding doctrine, and one that has a separation between church and state, if you like. Yes, we have Saudi Arabia. They're a Muslim nation. But if you look at the leadership of Saudi Arabia, it's not a democracy. And you have the king there and his son that are practices of Islam, but they don't believe in political Islam being dominated inside the governance of their territory by Islam. And yet, if you look into Iran, that's what we have, a theocracy in power. We don't have a democracy, a theocracy. And that's what they wanted to try and turn Egypt into. Give the chance for democracy in the Middle East and see where it comes. Now, I've been thinking how it comes. I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of days about what would have happened in the Middle East if Mr. Trump did not come into power. If the nuclear deal was never pulled out of, if financial sanctions were not restored on Iran, if the IRGC, basically this arm, massive arm of over 100,000 soldiers that operates outside the conventional military of Iran, if that group wasn't just designated as a foreign terrorist entity by the United States, what if the United States pulled out completely from the Middle East, completely? What would happen to Syria? What would happen to even western parts of Iraq? What would happen to what's going down, happening right now in Yemen? I mean, these are places that if Iran had a lot of money and access to a lot of money, which they would have had under the nuclear deal, their soldiers would have been marching to those territories. They would have been buying favors from people in those nations. And we could have seen a further destabilized Egypt for sure, if not again, for Mr. Trump and even the leadership of el-Sisi there right now. But just a little bit, I mean, what would happen in the Persian Gulf? Last time I checked, there wasn't any American servicemen being, or their boats being taken over by IRGC soldiers, being stood up and humiliated by the Iranians. That hasn't happened under President Trump. It might have even been that the U.S. Fifth Fleet would have pulled out of the Persian Gulf if Hillary Clinton was in power. And then in terms of this area down to the south in Yemen, there's right now a war obviously going on in Yemen. This is a horrific war and there's a lot of civilian casualties from it. I'm not talking about that side of it. That's obviously horrific. It's a humanitarian tragedy. But at the end of the day, right now you have an Iranian-backed, funded, armed, directed group that started this war, the Houthis. They're religious zealots that believe they are the true heirs to the land. And the Saudis went in there and said, we're not going to have Iranians on our southern doorstep that is putting in jeopardy all the trade, all the ships, the 20,000 ships that come through the southern gateway of the Red Sea off the coast of Yemen each year. We're not going to allow Iran to do that. And even yesterday, Mr. Trump had to veto a measure in the Senate, a veto that the Senate and the House passed to pull out of this war. I think it passed 54 or something like that to 46 in the Senate. I'm not sure exactly. But there was support in the House, even now, support in the House and in the Senate in the United States for a pullout completely of the war in Yemen. And though while it is a human tragedy, I mean, the Saudis right now and the Saudi war effort right there is preventing Iran from controlling a major gateway of goods, a major way that anything that gets from the Mediterranean Sea down to the Indian Ocean or the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea has to pass through the Suez. That's the famous one. But the Bab el-Mandab, the Gate of Tears in the very south, just a 20-mile stretch, that is controlled by, right now, thankfully, in terms of world trade, by the Saudi-backed government. And the Houthis aren't fully able to close that. They've tried. They've tried. Iran's given them surface-to-ship missiles to fire at ships going through there, and they've done that. Iran's given them naval mines to lace the bottom or the upper portion of the water there across that strait. The Houthis have done that. They've even supplied them with explosive boats by remote control, actually they can direct into warships or other ships passing through there in the Bab el-Mandab. And they've done that. They've done all these things, the Iranians. They want control of this. And the United States under President Trump is backing a war to basically say, no, you can't have that. And here we have Iran that's suffering under financial sanctions that can barely feed its own people. And yet they're still pushing towards these foreign objectives. Imagine if there was no Mr. Trump backing up the Saudis and others right now to try and stop Iran's push across the Middle East. Now, we're not even going to talk about what would happen in Lebanon, but we do want to talk about what would happen in North Africa. Now, this is where Iran needs to make a move still. If Iran wants to be a power that can really control a lot of world trade through the Strait of Hormuz on the other side of the Persian Gulf or on the other side of the Saudi Peninsula or this Bab el-Mandab, it's going to be really helpful for them to control Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. Now, this is a time to notice what's going on in North Africa. Iran right now would be going overtime to nurture its relations in North Africa if it had a lot of money. It's already doing it, but on a limited degree. Now, again, stopping Iran from maintaining or from getting in control of North Africa means preventing for a time this prophetic trigger for World War III going off. And so while we might say, well, what happens in North Africa doesn't affect me, well, it does. It does, because this is a territory that Iran needs to control before it can push at that King of the North. Everything, in fact, is connected to Iran's control over North Africa. It will affect you. That's what the Bible says, and that's why we've been putting stories up on the website just over the past week and a half about Libya, about Algeria, Tunisia, Sudan, Egypt. Why are we focusing on these places of the world that no one else really focuses on? Well, because we know that destabilization in those areas will be capitalized on by Iran, that will then give them the Western arm of their empire, which will allow them to push at Europe, as the prophecy in Daniel says. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about North Africa and how what's going on right now parallels the Islamic Spring of 2012 and how dangerously close we got back then to Iranian control over Egypt.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
We don't really like to think in terms of archaic religious wars, but when you see the iconic church of the Cathedral of Notre Dame burned to the ground and people in tears in France and elsewhere throughout Europe, you know that there is a historic yearning in Europe to defend their shared Christian faith, whether or not they're actually practicing Christians themselves. I mean, we see this in Jerusalem all the time, where you have a unreligious majority being motivated by what is seen as an attack on their identity. That even though they're like not Muslim, not really, you know, practicing Muslims to the degree that they're ready to, you know, go up and take over Jerusalem, that's probably 5-10%. But when they see like their holy sites, like the Temple Mount or Al-Aqsa, as they see it, come under threat, it's like this: the public just wells up in support, that is ready to throw down arms against what they see as an attack on their history and their religion. And the same is going to be true in Europe. And Richard Palmer's been talking a lot about this, how you might not have a mass right now inside Europe attending church on Sundays or mass on Sundays. When push comes to shove and you have outsiders attacking monuments of their Christian heritage, there would be moments where they would rise up. And that's what the Bible says. Now, in North Africa, we have many, many parties that actually want, many political parties that want political Islam to take over. Now, they're all Muslim nations in North Africa. Some of them don't want a separation of church and state. Most of the people don't want a separation of church and state. Generally, you have this, the so-called dictator that Western leaders are so easy and so readily, or so ready to ditch for their suppression of national will, because they're just trying to keep a lid on the national expression of Islam. But you have the majority of the public that are actually going to be for it. But you have strong men rule. If it's, you're talking about Egypt, if you're talking about even Saudi Arabia, if you're talking about parts of Libya, this warlord Khalifa Haftar that's based out of the east on the border with Egypt, that's marching on Tripoli all the way in the west right now, he's an anti-Islamist. He does not want Islamist rule. They fear Islamist rule, even though they're Muslim. They fear the taking over political Islam of their nations. The truth is that if democratic rule took place, purely democratic rule took place in North Africa, a place where there's no Judeo-Christian roots, it would lead eventually into anarchy and Islamic rule. That's what we've seen. There might be an exception with Tunisia, but everywhere else, where a strong man is removed from power, the Islamists take over. And you might say, well, so be it. So be it. If that's what the people want, democracy says that they should be allowed to have it. Well, if that's the case, then you're going to have Islamic nations to the south of Europe that eventually go radical. And that's the way that the Muslim Brotherhood was going when they took power back in 2012. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Free and fair elections will always be influenced by subversive Islamist powers that see democracy as a Western anti-Allah form of government, but they will use it to accomplish their means. And so what do we have? We have strongman rule or anarchy. Now, there might be moments of quiet in the Middle East democracy, but there are only moments. There are breaks either between a return to strongman rule or a wasteland of tribal warfare, like what we've seen in the post-Gaddafi era, the 7 years that Gaddafi was removed, jihadis fighting against non-jihadis, no real solid structure of power, migrants being forced up into Europe, and a whole host of problems that comes through that. But right now we're at this point where we're having dictators be removed from power. I don't want to call them benevolent dictators because they're not a lot of the time. But they understand their people. They understand what would happen if they're not there. And they understand how dangerous that would be for the world. We have this article from Walter Russell Mead. He replaced Brett Stevens, who went to the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal for their global view. So he writes a global column, and it's entitled The West and Middle East Dictators. And I just want to quote at length here because it is this notion that is really a Obama administration doctrine that still pervades the State Department and a lot of the other national United States foreign policy think tanks, that democracy needs to have its course in Africa, in North Africa, in these Islamic nations. And you might say again, fine, but he just talks about the result. Walter Russell Mead does. I just want to quote him now. It says, another spring, another set of political crises in the Arab world. This time, autocratic rulers, long past their sell-by dates, have fallen in Algeria and Sudan. In both countries, factionalized ruling elites, insulated for decades from political pressures other than backstairs intrigue, now scramble to satisfy angry throngs of protesters without any idea of how this can be done. We can recite the mantras of development theory and democracy promotion. Economic reform and political opening are what the region needs, we can say. Such platitudes, he writes, are as useless as they are true. An inexorable buildup of economic and social pressure, like an upwelling of molten rock from beneath the earth's crust, threatens to engulf the dysfunctional post-colonial social orders in states from Pakistan to North Africa, and nobody in the region or in the West has the slightest idea what to do about it. Nobody knows what to do. You have populations that are poor, populations that are suffering from unemployment, populations that are governed by Islam, and they are upset with their ruling class and the dictator a lot of the time that is ruling over them, and they want him gone. They want something different. Okay, so we remove him. Then what happens? Well, we don't have to talk about what happens. We had an example exactly of this back in 2011 and 2012. We'll get to that in a second. Just want to continue the quote here from further down. It says here, it's against this backdrop that we must understand the political experiments in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman seem to have decided they cannot govern their countries by adopting the values and institutions of contemporary Western democracy. I'm sorry, we just can't do it. It would be good if democracy could have its way in our nations, but we just can't do it. It's like if you remember President Obama calling up Hosni Mubarak and saying, I want you to go. I want you out of power. Hosni Mubarak did an interview with an ABC person. And basically, we can't get the audio because he wasn't speaking English. But she related that he basically said that President Obama doesn't understand our culture. I like the man, but he doesn't understand our culture. If I leave, the Muslim Brotherhood's going to get in power. And then what's going to happen? And the president about that time had an interview with Bill O'Reilly, and he asked him about that. So you want Mubarak to go? Well, what about if the Muslim Brotherhood gets in power? Well, I mean, they are a movement that has a lot of organization there in Egypt, but they don't have a presidential figure. They won't get in power. But really, he was moving the whole time to allow them to get into power, as we'll cover. So you have right now Sisi in Egypt, and it's hard to see a case where Iran is going to gain power in Egypt with this man still in power. It's very difficult. He's basically, I think it's yesterday, constitutional reforms will take place where he can stay in power for another 10 years. And he is anti-Muslim Brotherhood. He's jailed Mohamed Morsi, the former president of the country. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is kept at bay by him. And so while he's there, it's hard to see this going forward. But it will happen. It will happen eventually, and possibly this uprising that's taking place to their southern border in Sudan and their western border in Libya, and throw into the mix the jihadis, the Islamic State that still exists in the Sinai that the Egyptian military is fighting day in, day out. Every single border of Egypt is besieged by radicals, and they want to come over, and they have connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, so that is possible. Nevertheless, you have them ruling as a dictator of sorts. That is Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and this LCC, and they understand that if you remove them, democracy is not going to work out well for their nations of the West. It says here, will the Middle East would-be enlightened despots succeed? Talking about these two leaders. Maybe not. Sometimes the enlightenment fails, and all that remains is the despotism. Even despotism could fail, leaving more countries to follow the Syrian and Libyan paths to barbarism and anarchy. Western observers can and often must deplore the repression that new authoritarians impose, but we have no solutions to offer. We may not like what these rulers are doing, but we do not really know what they should be doing instead. And so that is kind of the position of the United States right now under President Trump. We don't know what to do. We're going to leave them in power, these strongmen that are putting at bay the radical Islamist camp. It's not the best way. I'm sure there's a lot of freedoms that are removed by these rulers over their people, and there are. But what other alternatives are there? Well, there was an alternative, and there is an alternative according to the Obama doctrine, and that was to embrace not the benevolent dictators, if I put him in that way, I'll just say dictator, that understands his people, but to replace them with the ruling majority, whatever that happens to be. And in some cases, and as they planned all along, it is going to be an Islamist group, a moderate Islamist group, as they call it. Back in 2010, before the Islamic Spring actually took place, the Arab Spring took place, President Obama, he directed a couple of foreign policy advisors to put together a document. This document was called PSD 11, known as the Presidential Study Directive Number 11. This has not been released to the public yet. It needs to be. It needs to be declassified because in it, from what's been leaked of it, you'll see that it detailed a Muslim outreach to parties such as the Muslim Brotherhood by the Obama administration to allow for the removal of the dictators and embrace, it seems, it's hoped, a more moderate form of Islam, and that would rule over the people. That was their goal. This report was put together by Samantha Power. She was in charge for a time of Obama's Syria policy. Ben Rhodes was there, of course. He was in there mixing, or putting his, as he calls it in a quote here, he said to David Ignatius back in March 6th about this, "The democratic youth movement sweeping the Arab world offered an alternative narrative to the versions of Islamic revolution put forward by Iran." So he was saying, this was Rhodes was saying, that this is an opportunity to embrace the youth movements of political Islam in Egypt, and maybe that will be a successful form of governance over the people. And this, you know, this directive came through, and it came to the hands of Hillary Clinton, and she incorporated it as well. She went over there to Qatar and Saudi Arabia and told them to try and embrace more inclusive forms of government, to embrace the moderate of the Islamic people and political parties in their midst. But they didn't do it because they, again, understood their people. Now, this is the backdrop to the Islamic Spring. If you remember this time, Cairo, I wrote the trumpet brief last week about it. I remember this like it was yesterday because I was fairly new in the news bureau of the trumpet. I was there in my office in Edmond, Oklahoma, and I was watching live on Al Jazeera the protests in Tahrir Square that went on for almost 3 weeks. And it was compelling. This is the first time I watched Al Jazeera, actually. At the time, Al Jazeera wasn't that popular in the West. And I almost felt like, you know, my IP address was going to be tagged by the State Department as a foreign helper to jihadists because I was watching this. But nevertheless, it was like the most compelling thing to watch these massive protests, a mass movement against the strongman rule of Hosni Mubarak, and the United States come in and say, yeah, it's time for you to go. And then within a year, they had these elections from that moment. And who's elected in power? Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's his greatest foreign policy objective? That's an outreach to Iran. For the past 30 years, Egypt and Iran hated each other. Egypt hated Iran because of what they did to the Shah. And they saw Iran as a dangerous nation in terms of pushing a radical Islamist agenda. And they always feared it. They didn't open any embassies in each other's countries. They were the only two Arab states or Islamic states not to do that. They banned all flights in between the two capitals. But as soon as Mohamed Morsi comes into power, it's back on. Ahmadinejad is over there in Egypt, in Cairo. And then you have Morsi flying over to talk to the Ayatollah. And here you have, again, this what people fail to see. They're like, well, Egypt, that's a Sunni jihadist nation. And Iran, well, that's a Shiite jihad or a Shiite Islamic nation and a Sunni Islamic nation. They shouldn't get together. But they do. They do get together because they both believe in the unity of the Islamic world. They both hate Israel. And they both believe in the implementation of a united Muslim nation. They might fight eventually over who's in charge of that nation. But Sunni or Shia, these in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Iranian regime, they believe in coming together. And this was actually encouraged by the Obama administration. We had embassies opening up on both nations. We had those flights starting up between Cairo and Egypt. We had Ahmadinejad in Cairo saying there that this new relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is opening up North Africa to Iran. And at the time watching this, I mean, we were like, this is it. This is Bible prophecy right here. This is Daniel 11 verse 40 happening before our eyes. With the western and the eastern parts of the King of the South coming together. And we even had Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds Force. He was in Cairo. What was he doing over there? Well, he was talking to the foreign policy advisor, Mohamed Morsi, and they were discussing how to set up a parallel surveillance or parallel intelligence and military apparatus inside Egypt, similar to the IRGC. It would act... Not as part of the official military makeup, and it would be separate to preserve the new Islamic regime of Egypt. That's what they were doing. Now, none of this came out till years after. You've got to go start reading things in 2017, 2018, to actually see how deep the relationship was between Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And why did Iran do it? Well, even this past week, we had a Michael Young, he did an interview, I forget with what the Iranian strategist was, but they were talking about how Iran wants to use the network that the Muslim Brotherhood has in North Africa. The Muslim Brotherhood basically backs Sudan's president until he fell recently. Muslim Brotherhood's huge down in Sudan. It's also pretty big in Libya. They have connections all over North Africa. And of course, they have strong connections in Egypt. And even right now, we have the Iranian regime that's reaching out to the younger segment of the Muslim Brotherhood that are willing to jump in bed with the Iranian regime to put forward a pan-Islamic caliphate. The older guard seems to be a bit more wary of Iran, it seems, and for good reason. But here again, we have this situation brewing in North Africa, one that was that's been very similar to the Islamic Spring back in 2011 and 12. And that's important because, again, a necessary precursor to this push of the King of the South at Europe is control of this swath of territory. This is going to happen. Eventually, we are going to see the Iranian nation led by radical Islam, probably led by the Ayatollah himself, have a really close relationship with Egypt, and how that relationship, as we've said, is going to push the Libyans, the Ethiopians, and the Sudanese probably into one massive, I don't want to call it empire, but kingdom of is a kingdom ruled by this King of the South. That's what Bible prophecy says is going to happen. Now, if you want to understand more about this, you really need to request our editor-in-chief's book, The King of the South. It's amazing to go into the details of these prophecies, because they lay out the strategy of Iran so clearly. And this strategy, as we see North Africa basically explode right now, this strategy looks like it's going to be pushed forward as much as possible by Iran. A necessary precursor, again, to these prophecies taking place. Now, just go back and remember what I was saying at the beginning. This prophecy here in Daniel 11, this was the result of an aged prophet of God crying out to God for 21 days. It took two archangels to make sure that this prophecy was delivered. And then it took God, through miracle after miracle over the past 2,500 years, to have it preserved in the Bible so we could read it. And then in the past 30 years, it took God again to make clear who this king of the south was. Now, God did all of that so that we would understand. We, right now, being able to witness what's rising out of the Iranian Empire and this king of the south. God made all those miracles possible so that we would understand biblical prophecy, and he understood it. He gave it to us so that we would do something with it. Do something with it. This isn't an intellectual exercise to understand Bible prophecy. This isn't something that just gets us excited to see how it's all coming together and then it's an end in itself. We know the end. The end is going to be the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. This is the first move. This push is the first move towards that world-changing, life-changing, universe-changing event. But God expects you to be a part of this event. And you can be if you put these prophecies together and you let it motivate you to change. Motivate you to change. Again, if you want to request more of information on this, you can go to The Trumpet, read all the articles about North Africa, and please do request the booklet by our editor-in-chief, The King of the South.